Thanks for having me out here. This is pretty awesome. Let me say in advance that I am down with a bit of a cold right now, so you're going to get a slightly low energy talk. But anyway, that's just how it is. So this talk's going to be about, since I'm coming to PI, I chose to talk about my most sort of mathematical, theoretical ongoing project, and that's something that relates to thermalization. Should I do anything? Okay. Relates to thermalization, Markov chains with unusual properties, and so on. If this sounds like something you're not usually interested in, don't worry. I think I tried to make the talk sort of easy to follow. So just, if this is not your usual stuff, just view this as like some light entertainment. It should be fine. Okay, first things first, meet the team. So these are the people I've been doing this work with. Shankar on the left is a grad student at MIT, someone I've been working a lot with recently. It's really fun collaborating with him on various QI mathy kind of things. Alex is a grad student at BU, a longtime climbing partner, and it's fun to finally be able to write a paper with him. And then we've also been chatting with Sarang, who has provided lots of very useful advice. Okay, so here's what the talk's going to be about. It's going to be about thermalization. So I'm going to motivate the physics in this talk from kind of a naive perspective of someone who doesn't know a lot about thermalization, which that I am that kind of someone. So we're going to be kind of exploring this question of how fast do systems equilibrate, right? Physical systems equilibrate. Of course, everyday experience tells us that the answer is usually fairly quickly. I'll try to be a little bit more precise by what I mean by fairly quickly. But we also are familiar with examples of systems which either they equilibrate very slowly or maybe they don't equilibrate at all. Right. So examples might be glasses, both like structural glasses, like window glass, or spin glasses in the CS sense, or in many body physics sense, or maybe more sophisticated examples might be systems with that display many body localization. Construct some more examples of systems which thermalize very slowly, but we're going to be coming at this from a very different kind of perspective than the sort of standard examples of slowly thermalizing systems that I gave on the last slide. So we're going to be doing things which are rather different from glasses and a meal. And in particular, we're going to be playing this game. I'm going to treat this as a game where we are basically trying to design a physically reasonable system with an extremely long thermalization time. So our goal is just to make the thermalization time as long as possible. And the kind of stipulations of this game are, we have a few. So one is that we're going to work on a spatial lattice, and we're going to have a finite dimensional Hilbert space on each site. Okay, that's reasonable. The dynamics that we design is going to have to be spatially local, okay, in whatever sort of interpretation of that word you like. And also, we're going to have to be able to prove a bound on this thermalization time. So like mathematically demonstrate that the thermalization time is very long. Okay. So
previous literature, in which context could people prove such a bound?
Yeah, so if you think about like most glasses or MBL systems or something like that, right? You would usually be proving bounds in systems which are, for example, not spatially local, right? Like all-to-all spin glasses, you would be doing mean field stuff. There are some examples of kind of highly frustrated systems which are a little bit closer to what I'll be talking about, where you can prove things, which you'll see an example of.
But you mentioned that this is different from MBL.
Yeah, you'll see that the strategy is very different, right? So I bring up this, you must be able to prove a bound on the thermalization time, because I don't want to have to do like numerics, and I don't want to have to get in big fights about like how do I take the large system size limit and like very delicate stuff like that. So I want something where I can convince everyone in the audience that the thermalization time is long within the hour that I have. Right. Yeah.
And so this would depend on the system size, of course. So
yeah, so when I say long, it's going to be some scaling of the time with respect to thermalization time.
That's what
yeah, so I want, if I have a system of size L, I would like the thermalization tau to be as quickly growing a function of L as I can manage. Right. Maybe infinity, right? But at least growing as fast as possible. Yeah, great. Okay, so this is the game we're going to be playing. And I'm just going to tell you kind of in advance sort of what we're going to arrive at in the end. So we're going to construct a family of solutions to this game with long thermalization times. Okay, so here long, again, I haven't really told you what to expect, but for those people who are already familiar with this, the thermalization times are going to be like large powers of the system size, or perhaps exponential, or 2 to the square root of L, these kinds of scalings. I'm going to be kind of formulating things in the language of Hamiltonian dynamics, just because that's like what I normally do on a day-to-day level. But everything I'm going to be saying it'll be kind of clear that this will apply to particular types of random unitary dynamics or classical Markov processes, et cetera. These models are not going to rely on disorder in any way. So we're going to be free of a lot of complications of replica analysis and stuff like that you need to do in situations with disorder. And of course, the models that I'm going to be talking about are going to be very contrived because we're actually going to prove things with them, right? So they have to be contrived in some sense. But they won't be like ridiculously contrived. So we're not going to do anything that I view as incredibly unpalatable. Okay.
So will they be very fine-tuned or not?
You would call them very fine-tuned, yes. There's a class of perturbations which will preserve the provability. You'll see how in what sense they're exactly generic. It's kind of some like kinetic constraint thing, as you can imagine. So, I've been doing some other work on that I'm not going to talk about on the robustness with respect to generic perturbations, and that's a whole different story that I can tell you about later. But I guess for the purposes of this talk, let's not be bothered by writing down Hamiltonians which look very contrived, because we're just trying to demonstrate possibility in this talk. Yeah. Cool. Okay, so here's a review of kind of a naive perspective on how we expect thermalization times to scale in conventional systems, right? Coming from a very naive perspective, so just allow me to kind of adopt this naive perspective. Okay, so when we think about thermalization of a system, we're thinking about, for example, we start the system off in some particular state, and we let it evolve in time under whatever dynamics it possesses. And sort of we might expect that a system can only kind of start to approach equilibrium when it has a chance to spread out over all of phase space or Hilbert space, right? So that's kind of... We want to allow the system enough time to kind of explore everywhere. Of course, configuration space or Hilbert space is very large, right? It has sort of, if I have a system of size L, maybe the volume of this space that the system is exploring is of size 2 to the L. So maybe the thermalization time is also very long because you're moving around in a very big space, right? That's too fast because usually Hilbert space is very highly connected, right? I don't have to kind of spend a exponentially long time to get from one corner of Hilbert space to the other, because in a typical system, usually there are like lots of shortcuts that I can take to get from one point to another. Okay, so just kind of a very simple example, right? Each state is basically what we expect is that each state in the Hilbert space is only about system size steps away from every other state, right? So, as an example, just consider like this transverse field Ising model Hamiltonian, right? And ask, how many powers of the Hamiltonian, which is basically like how long of time, do I need to get between any two z basis product states, right? So that's at most L, right? Because each power of the Hamiltonian allows me to flip one spin, and I need to flip at most L spins, right? So I need at most L steps of the dynamics to get between any two states. Okay, so that means this I can get from any point to any other point along this dotted arrow and maybe L steps. So So this is what a typical, this is kind of like a schematic illustration of what a typical system might like look like in configuration space. I have a bunch of different states of the system. The volume is 2 to the L, but the sort of diameter of this graph of the different states the system can access is only about L. So it's a very kind of dense, highly connected graph. Make sense? So the implications of this is that if you have a thermalization time which is significantly larger than the system size, it needs to occur for some kind of a, maybe not special reason, but some reason which is, so there must be some physics which is kind of localizing the system within particular corners of configuration space, despite the fact that configuration space is very highly connected, right? So, for example, in like glasses, we usually think of there being a very complex energy landscape and different configurations having different energies, which may be very like non-resonant with each other. And so as the system kind of moves around in configuration space, it has to go through this very complex energy landscape. And that can lead to it taking a very long time to move around, right? OK, so from the perspective of we're just playing this game of trying to make long thermalization times, this is kind of the disadvantage of these kinds of systems. They're just very hard to understand, right? We've been thinking about glasses forever. Alternatively, you could imagine doing something like this, right? So I take my configuration space and I like split it into two big blobs and I draw one very, very narrow connection between the two blobs, right? Now, if I start off my dynamics in the left half, you know, I might have to wait a long time for the system to kind of notice that there's a link in between these two blobs, right? But that kind of requires, it's not obvious how to like construct physical models where their configuration space is connected in this way, right? Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
So can you go back to the previous slide on the diagonal connection from L?
Yeah.
Yeah. If I can usually expand like the time evolution of the T this order, then I also get the free factor, which is very small.
Yeah, of course. So I'm not this is like a very, very incredibly naive bound on just when the matrix elements start becoming non-zero, right? So of course, yeah, this is kind of like a crude lower bound on how long of a time I'm going to need to wait, right? Because, yeah, the matrix element may be very small, and so I'll have to wait longer than that for the kind of this overlap to reach its thermal expectation value, right?
Yeah, how large is required in order to thermalize? Essentially,
what is the design? We'd be asking how long does this take to approach its thermal expectation value? So usually that would be exponentially small, right? But so this is kind of a weird way of talking about thermalization because usually we're talking about expectation values of operators. We're not talking about like the overlap between two random states. That's a bit unphysical, but that's fine. We're taking this kind of naive perspective, and this is just like a crude lower bound on how long we have to wait, right? Yeah, and that's kind of the perspective we're going to be taking to make these proofs, right? You'll see more about what I mean about that in a sec. Yeah. Okay. Great. So I was just talking about this is kind of what we need to do to make long thermalization times in classical systems, right? So of course, when we have quantum systems, we can also use interference to try to localize ourselves, right? But having this work out requires, again, like rough energy landscapes, like in the glass problem where we have some disorder, or a very special connectivity, right? You might know that single particle on the beta lattice is localized, right? But that requires some very special type of connectivity of Hilbert space. And OK, this is also hard to understand. So we're not going to be pursuing this approach either. OK, so here's our strategy when we're playing this game. We're going to try to construct models where the connectivity of Hilbert space is changed in some qualitative way, right? So most systems are kind of very dense. Configuration space is very dense and highly connected. And we're going to try to make models where configuration space has like a very large diameter, right? It just takes a very, very large number of steps to get from any one point to any other point on average, right? So we're going to try to see how these kinds of models can be constructed. Okay. So to just give you an analogy, this is a typical system, is the Shanghai subway network. It's very highly connected, and if I want to get from one point to any other point, there are many, many different ways I can go there, and I can thermalize myself across Shanghai very quickly. Right? But we're trying to make models which are more like Boston, right? So people who have been in Boston will know that, especially, I think there are a lot of them in this room, that you know, you might find yourself at Cleveland Circle here at the end of the sea line. And you might want to thermalize yourself to Boston College, which is really not that far away if you were to directly walk, right? But if you were to evolve yourself under the Green Line dynamics, you might take like a whole day to get from one point to the other, right? So we're trying to design systems whose configuration space is like that of the Green Line. So, it's kind of related. So you'll see that the kind of dynamics we're going to be designing has some particular type of kinetic constraint. So if I go into if I kind of conjugate the kinetic constraint into a different basis, then I'll need to consider a model which is like kinetically constrained in some kind of weird basis. So that's going to be that might look a little contrived. So I would say no. There's going to be a particular basis that we're going to be thinking about in all of what I say. You'll also notice that everything I'm going to be saying is just is basically a statement about very weird types of classical Markov chains. So speaking about this in the context of quantum mechanics quantum thermalization is maybe a bit of overkill, but we're just kind of taking some classical process, and if you like to think about it in the context of a quantum model, you can. But there's going to be a preferred basis coming from the classical Markov chain. Yeah. As is the case with basically all the examples I know about where this phenomenon happens. So the slowest kind of examples of this Green Line type dynamics that I know about come from some kind of highly frustrated dimer models where you have some configuration of dimers, and to move from one configuration of dimers to another configuration, you have to do some very long and tortuous rearrangement of the dimer configurations, right? In these models, the best that one can do, as far as I'm aware, is like L squared. So normally a typical system might have a diameter, a Hilbert space diameter of like L, and these guys get L squared. But we're going to try to do better than that in this talk. Yeah. So what in particular, what we're going to do is construct models where this diameter, as a function of L, can be basically essentially any function that you want. If you like, you can view these as sort of extremely frustrated systems, right? In some very frustrated classical system, it might take you many, many rearrangements to go from one configuration to another, and we're going to try to make that frustration as extreme as possible. Okay. So to explain this, we need to take a short detour into the land of geometric group theory, which is some subfield of math that I've been having a lot of fun learning about recently, and which will be key to kind of all of our constructions. Okay. So geometric group theory concerns the geometry of discrete groups. Okay, so reminder on notation. We're going to have if I have a discrete group G, I'll write that group as in the presentation of that group in this way. So I have some generators of the group G1 to Gn. And those generators will obey some relations R. Okay, so here are some examples, right? So for the group Z, I have one generator and no non-trivial relations. For the group Zn, I have one generator and n powers of that generator are the identity E. And then, okay, S3 is something like this. I have a rotation and a flip, and they obey some particular relations. Right. Okay. So we're going to define something called a word as a string of the generators and their inverses and the identities. So it's just like we imagine that we have an alphabet which is given by the generators, their inverses, and a word will just be some string of letters in that alphabet. And there's a very famous problem in mathematics and computer science, which is known as the word problem for this group, which has kind of been studied for about 100 years now, starting from work by Max Dane a long time ago. And the word problem is as follows. If we're given a word W, we're asked to decide whether or not W represents the identity element. So that is, if we take a product of all the of all the characters in the word, do we get the identity element or not? Right. So for example, here are some kind of silly examples of word problems and their solutions. Right. So is G identity G inverse equivalent to identity? Well, obviously yes. Right. This one, GEG, well, that's G squared, that's not the identity, right? Okay, so then we have some other examples over here. Okay, so I think naively it might seem that this problem is kind of easy in general, right? We just multiply a bunch of the group generators and we know what the multiplication law is, right? So it can't be that hard to decide, right? But that's not true if I just choose, here's another example, sorry. Got ahead of myself. The mathematicians, if this wasn't clear, they're interested in basically the complexity of this word problem, right? So how long does it take me to decide whether or not a given word is the identity element or not, right? So when we're thinking about how long it takes, we're imagining that we're running some algorithm on this word and looking at the number of steps that algorithm needs to have in order to reduce this word to the identity element, right? So as an example, in the symmetric group, maybe I'll start off with a word, which, okay, FR, FR, F is the flip, R is the rotation, right? And then I'll use some successive applications of these local relations to reduce this word to the identity, right? In this example that I drew, this takes 3 steps, so the sort of complexity of this word problem would be like 3, right? The time complexity of this problem would be 3. I was saying before this slide that this seems like a very easy problem in general, but that's not really true, right? Because if I just give you a random, like a group which is a bit more complicated, so I just made this up, right? It may have some trivial simplifications, but I just randomly typed this out. If I get some random group like this, and I ask you to tell me whether or not this word is equivalent to the identity, it might be very tricky, right? Because you might not have, like, you're supposed to show that this is equivalent to the identity by using different combination of these relations, right? But maybe it's not obvious, like, which relations I should apply, right? Should I use this like CD inverse equals A minus 3B, or should I use another one, and which order should I do them in, right? So it can actually be very hard, you know, in general to solve this problem, right? And in general, here's the best strategy for solving this problem. We take our word, and we just randomly apply these local relations that, you know, that define the group at different points in the word, and we just wait until we just sort of randomly happen upon the identity word. That's the best strategy. And in general, there's no better strategy which will take advantage of any structure of the group. Okay? So I just come in here and I look, okay, R inverse F, let's change that to FR. I know that's a relation I can use. And then maybe I'm going to take identity R and then replace it with R identity, right? And I just kind of go at random points in the word and use these relations. Okay, so maybe, to me, that kind of sounds like some quasi-reasonable stat mech model, right? You have some dynamics which is acting on these group words, and the dynamics is local, and we're just kind of, you can imagine that maybe I have some Markov process which is like taking this word to other words by randomly applying these relations, right? And we're gonna take this kind of stat mech model and build some systems with long formalization times out of it.
That's random, that would be really random, right? But I mean, you can try to design something like a better quality algorithm if you increase your length of the string, you have the.
Right, yeah, good. Yeah, but that's true. So you may try to design some algorithm like that, but it could be that for some groups, like, you actually don't want to monotonically make the word shorter, right? It may be that I give you some word, and in order to reduce this to the identity, you have to use some relations which, like, make the word much bigger before you can, like, cancel everything out and simplify it, right? So in general, there's no algorithm that you can, there's no cost function that you can design which will allow you to solve this problem. This problem in general can even be undecidable. So you may not even know if there is a solution.
Yeah, but if you you just apply it randomly, does it guarantee that it will work in polynomial time?
So it depends on the group, yeah, as you'll see in a sec. So some groups are more complicated than others. And the way we want to, so this, of course, the CS people have been interested in this problem because they want to understand this gives you some sort of concrete problem where the sort of computational complexity of that problem can be determined by knowing stuff about group theory. And in order to kind of put all groups at an even footing, they define the complexity as just kind of all groups are treated using the same kind of algorithm. Strictly speaking, it's the non-deterministic complexity. So you imagine you can kind of like apply relations in superposition, and yeah, that in general that's the best approach. Yeah. Yeah, so for the way I motivated it, yeah. So words are kind of one-dimensional objects. So all the models I'm going to be talking about explicitly here in the talk are going to be 1D. If you'd like to make them higher dimensional, I can tell you how to do that. But I mean, they're already kind of weird enough. So you make them higher dimensional and they become super weird. Okay. They're just trying to demonstrate a point, right? But anyway, they start looking a bit less palatable in higher dimensions. Okay, so that's the word problem. So we're going to define. So there's a very crucial object in the study of the stuff, which is called the Dane function. This is the same Dane as Dane twist for people who know about that. So the Dane function is basically the longest. It's kind of the worst case complexity for words of a given length. Okay, so if I have a word of length L, it's the I take a maximum over all words of length L, and I ask about the number of steps needed to connect that word to the identity. And groups where this function is larger are kind of more complex because you have to spend more time, more relations reducing words to other words. Right? So Dane was originally interested in this in the context of like studying the fundamental group on manifolds with, yeah.
Infinite amount of time.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the maximum over all words of a fixed length of the fastest reducible path.
Okay.
So there's like a min-max thing, right? So I'm looking at the quickest possible time, the longest quickest possible time, right? Makes sense. Yeah. Groups with this larger value of the Dane function are more complex, right? So slower dynamics. Oh, and just the historical note, he was originally, you probably know Dane from the like Dane twists and stuff in topology. So he was trying to figure out like, suppose I have the fundamental group on some genus G surface. How do I know whether like a given path in this fundamental group is contractible to a point, right? It's not obvious in general if I have this path kind of going around a bunch of different cycles. So he figured out some algorithm which kind of shows whether or not a given loop is contractible to the identity. And this was kind of kick-started this field. Okay. So as I said, even pretty simple to write down groups can have a very large complexity in this sense. Okay. So here's an example on the top line. It's a group with two generators and there's one relation. Seems pretty innocuous, but the Dane function is exponentially large in the length of the word. So I'll need an exponentially long number of steps to reduce the word to the identity. Okay. And it's very easy to just make even more perverse examples. So I can add one generator and I can get doubly exponential in L. And this is a kind of amazing group. So I have two generators and I have one. Okay, it looks rather complicated, but I only have one relation between the two generators. And this one, is an iterated exponential where the depth of the iteration is the log of L, right? So you quickly can, using very, very simple to write down groups, you can quickly construct groups for which this Dane function runs in times longer than the age of the universe, right? So there's kind of a minor industry in mathematics which is devoted to coming up with the craziest examples. Oh, yeah, okay, good. So I should have said this. So all the groups with interesting Dane functions are infinite. So they have a finite number of even very small, say two, number of generators. But the number of elements you can get is infinite. So if I had a finite group where I had a finite number of elements to get to, it's easy to convince yourself that this Dane function is a constant. Because, you know, if I kind of come back, if I'm moving around in this group and trying to reduce things, then I'll eventually come back to where I started after a constant number of steps. And so, yeah. So all the interesting stuff is going to happen in infinite groups and indeed infinite non-abelian groups. Okay. Yeah. I haven't really talked about. So I said that we're taking a detour currently into geometric group theory. I haven't really talked about the geometric part of the story. I've just talked about this complexity. But you can relate sort of the time complexity of this algorithm to sort of the large-scale geometric features of the group. So you want groups which kind of are both infinite and have high expansion and stuff. I can tell you about that later. Okay, so these are some examples of these groups. Okay, maybe no one's going to ask this question here, but let's go back to physics, so end of detour. So by now the construction is maybe kind of clear of what we're going to be doing. We're going to fix our discrete group G, and we're going to consider some spin chain. Again, I don't really need to formulate this in terms of quantum mechanical stuff, but we're going to consider a spin chain where the on-site Hilbert space has one state for each generator, its inverse, and the identity. Right? So if I have a group with one generator, I would have a spin one Hilbert space. With two generators, I have spin two, et cetera. Right? Now, when I do this, each product, so this comes back to your question, Tim, about the basis dependence. So when I work in this basis, each product state defines a word in the group. Each product state in the computational basis, if you like, defines a word, right? So this word would be basically G2, for example. Right? So the Hilbert space of this model is the space of words in the group, right? Okay, and then of course we're going to consider dynamics, which is doing the dynamics of this word problem algorithm that I was talking about, right? So we're going to have dynamics which goes into your system and applies relations at each point on the chain, group relations at each point, right? So I might write down a Hamiltonian that looks like this. So here what I'm doing is I'm going into each site of the word, and I'm looking at locally. I have two elements, K and L, and I'll replace those with elements G and H if the product GH is equal to KL, right? So that's a relation in the group, right? When I take KL and I replace it with GH, I haven't changed the group element that I get by doing the multiplication along the word. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're just gonna, you can make this lambda anything you want. You could also do you could do a random circuit which has this type of constraints, right? But so what I'm gonna talk about is not gonna be sensitive to any kind of details of these parameters. It's just going to be sensitive to the fact that the only non-zero matrix elements of the Hamiltonian obey this particular type of constraint.
Make sure.
Yeah.
So the first element in that lives on the same time.
Correct. Yeah. So like I kind of gave an example of this on one of the things, right? So suppose my state is like identity G. H, G inverse or something, right? My Hamiltonian could come and it can like map this to G times the identity G inverse, right? So I'm just G commutes with the identity, so I'm just gonna do that. Or it could map this to like identity, because G inverse is the identity, stuff like that, right? So this is the sense in which it's fine-tuned, right? The only matrix elements which are non-zero are obeying this particular constraint. So in the system, when we evolve in time, when, like, for example, we do E to the minus AHT, we're just doing this randomly apply all possible relations and see what happens kind of algorithm, which is the algorithm that you use to solve the word problem, right? Okay, so now what we realize is that in these kinds of systems, the thermalization time is essentially bounded by the Dane function. So the, remember, the Dane function was like the maximum number of steps we had to take to get from one word to the other. So that's going to tell us basically the diameter of configuration space, right? Yeah.
I think of this configuration space as being like a KD graph or something.
Good. So I'm going to talk about that in a second. The configuration space is not quite Cayley graphs because each point in configuration space is a word, right? So each, if you like, each point in configuration space is a loop or a string or whatever in the Cayley graph. So a little bit more complicated, but thinking about the geometry of the Cayley graph is actually going to be important. Yeah. Okay. So. Yes, very good. Yes, very good. So of course, you know, it's probably obvious that a lot of what we're doing is just lifting results in the geometric group theory literature and putting them into physical systems, right? And in the literature, everyone is always thinking about worst case complexity because computer science just they always think about worst case complexity, right? So that the Dane function that I've introduced is the longest possible time to get from two points in Hilbert space, from one point to another, right? But that could be for some stupid reason, because it could be like maybe Hilbert space is like one giant highly connected blob and it has like one really long spindle over here, right? And then the worst case would say the distance between this thing to some element in here. And of course, the sort of physical thermalization time probably doesn't care about this very rare long spindle, right? It's kind of, you should be thinking about what goes on here. So you really need to make some statements about the average case complexity of this thing. So that's kind of actually the bulk of the like man hours on this paper were trying to prove results on average case complexity of this word problem algorithm. Not much is known about that, but it looks like in most of the interesting groups, the average case complexity is still very long. I'll give you an example in a sec. Yeah, thanks. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
What about symmetries or like table space representation?
Yeah, very good. Very good. So these models actually exhibit Hilbert space fragmentation, because if I have a word which is equivalent to some group element G, I'll get a different fragment for each value of that G, right? Because I can never take a word which reduces to G and replace it with a word which reduces to H if H is not equal to G. So what I'm talking, implicitly what I'm going to be discussing in all of this talk, I'm going to be kind of ignoring that part of the story, although it's interesting for other reasons, but I'm going to be ignoring that, and I'm just going to focus on a single connected sector, right? So in most models where, or in all the models I'm aware of, where you have different fragments of Hilbert space, each fragment behaves like a quickly thermalizing system. So if you look at the dynamics within a connected sector, it's very quick. In these examples, although there are different sectors, the dynamics within each sector is very slow. Yeah, did you have a question? Sure, yeah. I would prefer to think about always working on a finite size system and just looking at the scaling of the time with L, with the system size.
Well, you
need what?
Infinite
long. You would actually want a finitely long chain, because otherwise the time could be infinitely long.
I mean, if I'm running by the TL, I'm not L.
Sorry. Are you saying that the I might need to make the word bigger than L, and then yes, great, fantastic. That's a great point. That actually has a lot of interesting physical implications, which I'll talk about in a sec. Yeah, that's a great point. For the examples that I'm going to talk about in the next like 5 minutes, the sort of space complexity of the algorithm is going to be kind of trivial. You won't need to do that. So thinking about just you're restricting yourself to a finite system size is actually going to be sufficient. But indeed, you're correct. That's not true in general.
And also, yeah. if we make it periodic,
yeah,
it's not the same as a word. The fact that we could hash some short
terms. I don't think that the periodicity will change anything, but if you think otherwise, we can talk about it later.
In principle, it's not the same.
Okay, I'll give you my arguments for it later, and we can see if that's true, if you believe me or not. Yeah. Cool, great. Thanks for the questions. Okay, this is too abstract. Give me a concrete example. Okay, again, maybe people here don't say that, but most people would say this, right? Okay, so here's a concrete example. Fortunately, it's called the BS group, which is funny. So this group is, again, one of these amazing groups that there are hundreds of papers written. Just math people love this group for some reason. It was discovered in 1962, and it's actually one of the groups I wrote on a previous slide. I have two generators, and I have one relation. It's very simple to write down. Okay, but it has a Dane function, which is exponentially long. So I also wrote this down on a previous slide. And a kind of way to see that is as follows. So this relation is that when I try to move a B past an A, the A spawns another A, so it duplicates, right? So you can kind of intuitively understand why this has a long Dane time using this following example. So suppose I want to take this word and I want to reduce it to the identity, right? Or suppose this is like a subword of some bigger word, right? I have a B inverse and a B, and in order to reduce this to the identity, I need to bring the B next to the B inverse so I can kill them, right? Okay, but when I do that, I spawn an A. So if I have a lot of B inverses and a lot of Bs separated by an A, In the course of trying to simplify this thing, I'm gonna make exponentially more A's, right? So this kind of like the spawning of the A's as the B's move past them makes kind of moving around in the space of words take very, very long. Okay. I'm gonna try to discuss this property in a more geometric way, which will hopefully give you some intuition for why this is true. So to do that, I just have one slide, which is a reminder on what Cayley graphs are. Right, so a Cayley graph, we have a group, and we have a graph where we basically, the different nodes on the graph are different group elements, and we connect to group elements if they're related by multiplication through a generator. Right, so if we have the group Z4, this is the Cayley graph for Z4. The star just marks some origin. Right? We have Z, it looks like this. Z squared is this. I have two generators and they commute, right? So in the Cayley graph, I have one sort of, if you like, one two cell. Oh, my back's gonna die. That would be bad. Oh, I think it's because I'm calculating. I'm running a bunch of stuff in the background. I should, well, whatever. We'll see. Let me just plug it in, actually. I should have paused all that stuff before I started the talk. Okay, crisis averted. Okay, so these are Cayley graphs. And we have one kind of plaquette in the Cayley graph for each relation, right? All right. So this is the Cayley graph. This is part of the Cayley graph for this BS group. Okay. Again, I'm showing you this just to give you some like geometric picture for why the thermalization takes a long time. Right. So I have a generator as A, which move me along the orange arrows, and I have B, which goes along the purple arrows. And the relation is that if I do AAB, I get the same as doing BA. Right? So I just make the space, I take a bunch of these plaquettes and I glue them together in such a way that gives me the space. So it kind of looks like a hyperbolic plane, right? The cells are getting exponentially more dense as I kind of move down, related to this spawning feature I was talking about, right? So unfortunately, I haven't really drawn the full graph here. The full graph is a bit more complicated. You take all these like hyperbolic planes, And you glue them together in some very like perverse way where there's like a hyperbolic plane which comes out of every hyperbolic plane and they get glued together in some crazy tree kind of shape. I guess I don't really need to go into too much detail about this, but let me just illustrate why, give you this geometric picture here. Now, as we said, different states in configuration space are words in this group. Okay, let's think about a word which is reducible to the identity. Right? That word will be a closed loop in this graph, right? Because if I get the identity, then I move around and I eventually come back to where I started, because the group element is the identity. Okay, so suppose we have some word which looks like this. It's some closed loop in this graph, right? Now, the amount of time I need to connect this word, to kind of thermalize this word, to kind of reach a generic state, if I start from this initial state, is equal to the number of relations that I have to apply to this word to reduce it to the identity. Now, each relation is just moving the word, moving this loop past the plaquette in this graph, right? Because each plaquette is a relation in the group, right? So that was one relation. That's another. Boom, 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 boom. Okay. So the number of steps I had to do to complete that process is basically the time it takes to thermalize starting from that particular state. Okay. And then here's an example of a word with very large thermalization time. Right. I kind of do this thing. So I have these hyperbolic planes. And I kind of do this kind of a big arc, right? So you can see that this arc, the area enclosed by this arc is sort of exponentially more than its perimeter, right? Because in a hyperbolic plane, if I do some big arc in this hyperbolic plane, I enclose very, very large number of cells. The number of cells I enclose is exponentially larger than the perimeter, right? Okay, so this is where the geometry and geometric group theory comes in. You need to understand like a typical state in Hilbert space is some typical like loop in this graph, and then what is like the area of this loop? The area is going to determine the thermalization time of the system. So you need to make statements like that. So the worst case complexity here, basically the largest possible area of a given word, is exponential in L, and to Yojun's point. Of course, what we're really interested in is the typical complexity. So yeah, we spent a long time trying to prove this, but it seems like we succeeded. So the thermalization time is kind of, in these systems, is about 2 to the square root of L. The square root of L is versus L is coming from the average case versus the worst case. Okay. So as far as I know, this is the slowest kind of thermalizing, or the most frustrated classical model that I'm aware of. Okay, this is still too abstract. Show me some numerics. Again, maybe people here don't say that. Let's think about this group, and here's where kind of physically this actually gets interesting, right? I've kind of been talking about this thermalization in a very abstract sense, but we can be a lot more concrete in this example. So in this example, we have one relation, we have two generators, A and B. And the relation conserves the number of B's, right? So when I'm applying this kind of word dynamics to my system, the number of B's in the system is going to be conserved. So there's some conserved U1 charge, right? So let's study the transport of this charge, right? As you can imagine, it's kind of unusual. So what I'm going to do here in this, I'm going to show you a movie. What the movie is on the left slide here, I've started the system. I'm showing the kind of density of B particles in a system. So I've prepared basically a charge density wave of this conserved quantity, and I'm now going to look at how this charge density wave evolves under this word dynamics, right? Okay, so here's what happened. Oh, and then on the right, I'm going to show you kind of the fluctuations in B. The extent to which the B density is not uniform. Okay. So looks like this. What's going to happen is that it will eventually thermalize, by which I mean reach some state where the B density is uniform across the system. But it takes a long time to do so. So a lot, how long it is, I'll substantiate in the next slide. And moreover, it kind of it basically retains a density wave shape for a very long time until it suddenly kind of, the density wave kind of suddenly collapses, right? So we have this structure where we have kind of a, maybe it's not so obvious on this plot, but we have kind of like a plateau, and then it sharply drops and we thermalize. It turns out that in the infinite system size limit, this is like a step function. So you have that, you set up your density wave and you wait, and then nothing basically happens to the density wave for exponentially long times. And then all of a sudden, once you get to an exponentially long time, the density wave just instantly disappears, basically. Okay. So another way of phrasing this is, if you like, maybe, is that the diffusion constant as a function of wave vector goes like e to the minus 1 over q, which is very, very slow. Okay. I don't know. Maybe. People seem to call many different things dynamical phase transitions. I don't know if you would call that, you would use that word here. There's some expectation value of some operator where the expectation value is a discontinuous function of time, basically, in the thermodynamic limit. I don't know if that counts as a phase transition.
So how does this function behave in the signature of the jump? Is it this manifold
function? There's kind of like an avalanche that is occurring. Basically, once you start decaying, it happens sort of, the rate of decay picks up exponentially quickly. So it takes like exponentially long to decrease the density wave by some certain factor, and then decreasing it by the same factor will take, you know, half the time, and then half the time, and half the time. Yeah.
Just to kind of understand what the dynamics are here, so it's like a string of A, B, inverses, and E.
Correct, yeah.
Randomly according to the rules.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
And what kind of state are you initializing in? Like, is it packed with A's and B's, or?
It's actually a pretty dilute density wave. So it's like maybe a bunch of identities, and then some B's, and then some like an A, and then some B inverses, and some B's, and some B inverses, like that. I can write down the exact initial state for you. But if you just choose a typical initial state where the B's and B inverses are distributed in some density wave, then this is the behavior that you get. It doesn't really matter the exact initial state you choose. Cool. All right. So if you study this kind of decay time as a function of system size, you can confirm that it takes exponentially. Oh, okay, so we've checked the boxes there with the numerics. Let me now address this comment about the finite size space condition, which, yeah, for time reasons, I didn't really have time to go into. So the whole talk that I've been giving so far is about the time complexity of this word problem, how long it takes to map one word to another word. But equally interesting is the space complexity of this problem. How much like memory, working memory, do I need to run this algorithm, right? So as I was mentioning earlier, it may be that for some groups, I may not be able to reduce a given word to the identity using the space available to me by the system. So it may be the case that in the process of like reducing this word, I may have to make it bigger. Right? In fact, maybe I might have to make it a lot bigger. Right? So this is kind of a illustration of this. I start with some word of this length, and it's only reducible to the identity if I pass through some intermediate word which is much bigger than the system size. Okay, I hope that makes sense, that is possible, right? So you might imagine something like that could happen in this BS group example because of this property that I showed, right? When I try to simplify this word, I end up making it a lot longer, right? Okay. So this can essentially lead to an extreme form of jamming, which I'll try to illustrate here. Basically, what happens is that so in the phenomenon of jamming, right, we have we have a system that this is usually illustrated in some context of some like classical model of hard balls. So I have some system like this. I have a bunch of hardcore interacting balls in it. If the density of these balls is kind of too high, they might get completely frozen and stuck and not be able to move around, right? But if I were to give the system an extra amount of space for these balls to move into, they could rearrange themselves and then come back in a different configuration, right? So I would be, the ergodicity of the system would be kind of activated by giving the system extra space. Okay. In these examples, of jamming, the amount of extra space I have to add is usually just proportional to the the system size, right? I just need to decrease the density by some below some critical value. In these examples here, it's not hard to imagine that this extra amount of space can be like some very large function of the system size. So you can view this as some kind of extreme form of jamming, right, where the sort of jamming length is some large function of the system size. Right?
So if you don't have that path, do you not thermalize at all?
Right. You don't thermalize at all. Or rather, well, so you have to tell me what you define by thermalization. You would not be ergodic if you're limited to a smaller subsystem, right? So you could let me try to illustrate that in a more maybe familiar setting. We're thinking about, again, this doesn't have to necessarily be discussed in the context of quantum mechanics, but let's think about how we usually understand quantum thermalization, right? I have a pure state, and I have a subsystem. And the complement of the subsystem usually serves as a bath for the subsystem, right? So and in typical models, I need to take the subsystem. The size of the bath has to be a factor of a few, the size of the subsystem, in order for this reduced density matrix to look thermal, right? In these examples, the bath may need to be much larger than the subsystem. So this reduced density matrix will not approach its like infinite size limit until the bath is, say, exponentially larger than the subsystem. Right. So you have some example which kind of violates the normal things we would expect from ETH or whatever, where subsystems need to be incredibly, incredibly small before they start looking, they approach their infinite size limit. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Let me skip this slide. So here are some things that I'd like to think about in the future. So one thing which I didn't talk about is the robustness of these kinds of models. So if I just take my dynamics and I add some random term to it, say term to the Hamiltonian, which violates all of this nice all of these nice properties, what happens, right? So that's some story that's going on right now. Thinking about these kind of models from the point of view of anomalous hydrodynamics, so a lot of people have been thinking about ways of getting unusual types of scaling relations in hydrodynamics recently. These provide you with some examples. And other stuff like this. I'll stop there. Thanks for listening. Yeah. Not really any symmetries generically. So you have these. Yeah. So let's discuss whether you want to call that a symmetry, right? So, I think the parlance these days is non-local conserved quantity. So you have some conserved quantity, which, as you said, is this like group element that you get by doing the multiplication. But for most groups, in fact, for non-abelian groups, more precisely, that you cannot measure that quantity using any operator that we would like to think of as a symmetry generator. So I can't, because you kind of have to, you know, if I want to know what group element I get, I can't look at each site individually, separately, with respect to the other sites. I have to look at all the sites at the same time and do some group multiplication or whatever. And that means that to diagnose what sector I'm in, I have to use a operator which is supported on the entire system. So there are these conserved quantities, but they're not, I wouldn't call them symmetries in the conventional sense.
So this U1 is
That's a regular conserved quantity, but most groups will not have a particular conserved quantity in that fashion. Yeah.
So the group that you mostly talked about here, this VS group, has singly exponential.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes that seems like it should be sort of optimal for this like 1D thing because you only have singly exponential large Hilbert space.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
These worse, like double exponential groups on
this. Yeah, fantastic comment. So in that case, that implies that the space complexity must necessarily be larger than L. So as you said, I'm limited by the Hilbert space. So the only way that I can run this algorithm is to add more space, right? So that means that if I am in a system of size L, Hilbert space is going to break into more different sectors, right? Because I'm not able to connect them. That's when all this stuff about subsystems and stuff comes in. So all these examples I was discussing where you had like subsystems only thermalized when they were incredibly small, those examples come up when you have a Dane function which is, say, doubly exponential in the system size. Yeah, exactly.
You're in the structure of something weird about thermalizing dynamics. So is there anything weird about the equilibrium properties once it thermalizes?
I mean, naively, I expect that depends on the particular type of model you consider. So,
BS.
Yeah, but okay, but again, so let's fix that. But then I didn't tell you what the Hamiltonian was. I didn't tell you what you could have. You can put any Hamiltonian you can think of, which has these constraints, right? Some Hamiltonians might have many body localizations. Some of them might not. Some of them might be gapless, or some might not, right? So it depends on the structure of the Hamiltonian. There may be more universal things, which are like when you put this constraint on the Hamiltonian, does that affect like the level statistics or whatever of any kind of Hamiltonian that you have in the space? But I think in general it depends on the exact model of how you do the dynamics. There are some certain kind of canonical models that you might imagine where, for example, the ground state could be a uniform superposition over all words in a given sector. That would arise when you took your Hamiltonian to be some frustration-free projector, which is constructed out of these things. So that's a natural model you might think about. In that case, the structure of the group will have implications for how entangled the ground state is. So you could have ground states with the kind of entanglement scaling of the ground state will depend on sort of the geometry of the group in some way. I don't know. There are lots of statements to make, but it might be a case by case thing. Yeah.
This notion of does it also extend to the dynamics of local observables? The local observables also take this long time.
Yeah, exactly. So that question is, of course, very important, and that's why I illustrated this density wave thing in the BS group, right? So there we have a very concrete local observable, which is just a B density on each site, right? And that took exponentially long to relax, right? Okay, now in a generic group, I don't know if that's true. So if I just randomly choose a group with a very long thermalization time, can that thermalization be diagnosed through local operators? I actually don't know. In some examples, that's definitely true, like this BS example. But in general, I'm not sure. Could be the answer is no.
Are there any more questions? Yeah, there are no questions.
Cool. Thank you.